episode 22 of Thinking Habits podcast. Coming from quite a cold Sunday morning.
Yeah,
isn't it? It's a bit chilly. It's quite nice though. It's always relatively fresh, and the geese are still around. If you can hear them in the background.
And it is mid October.
Yeah. So we should be expecting that. So intros. I'm Simon.
I'm Pamela.
And we're always rubbish at doing those intros, but hopefully you should know that by now. And today we're talking about happy chemicals, in particular dopamine and serotonin, and a little bit also about oxytocin and endorphins. The reason for this is basically we're getting down to basics when it comes down to what goes on in your brain. It is basically a balance of those, put in its basic terms, depending on what your brain is doing with those chemicals, how it's making them, what's in there, what's not in there, where they're going and how they're being used, has been linked to basically almost every neurological function, really.
Yeah.
So before we go into the ins and outs of why we want to talk about it, just a little bit of an intro into what each one does. So dopamine plays a huge role in a human's motivation and reward. If you've ever worked hard to reach a goal, or you know, that kind of sense of satisfaction that you feel, it's partly due to a rush of dopamine. You often get that dopamine hit when if you feel like kind of warm and a sense of satisfaction. So symptoms of depression can include low motivation, feeling helpless, a loss of interest. Experts believe that these symptoms are linked to a dysfunction in your dopamine system, and they may also be triggered by short or long term stress, pain or trauma. And then alongside that, serotonin researchers are linking serotonin and depression, and they have done for almost 50 years. While they initially believed that low serotonin levels caused depression, they now know this isn't the case. The reality is more complicated. While low serotonin doesn't necessarily cause depression, increasing serotonin through the use of SSRIs is one of the most effective treatments for depression. However, they do take time to work. So among people with moderate to severe depression, more than half only report an improvement in their symptoms after they've taken SSRI meds. Like me, for 6 to 8 weeks. When I went back on antidepressants when I had my last severe depressive episode a few years ago, it did take at least 6 weeks. This suggests that simply increasing serotonin isn't what treats depression. Instead, research has suggested that these SSRIs increase positive emotional processing over time, which then produce a shift, result in an overall shift in mood. But it is still linked to the way that the brain uses serotonin in some way.
Yeah, and you also, this can be why you feel worse before you feel better, which any doctor should warn you before putting you on SSRIs.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you are tinkering with what the brain assumes is the right balance, and you are essentially artificially imbalancing the brain, aren't you?
Yeah, and it's certainly something I've experienced, and I know you did as well. But being forewarned of it means you know it will pass. And there is a certain element of just riding it out and accepting that you've got a couple of weeks where things are going to look pretty horrible.
Yeah, it's going to suck.
And going off on a slight tangent, it's where they talk about people being at risk of suicide and self-harm, not when they're at the lowest, but when they start medicating, because it starts, you know, you're changing your brain chemistry again.
Well, a lot of that is also to do with the fact that when you're absolutely at rock bottom, you don't have the drive, the energy, the motivation, or the impetus to do anything. You're at such a low mood that you can barely function. The riskiest point is when you start introducing a tiny bit of drive or a tiny bit of impetus or a tiny bit of motivation, because if you've still got the low mood but you've now got motivation, that's when you're at most risk of doing something that could end up harming yourself, because it's just enough energy for you to go and do something, you know, self-harm. And that's when I was working nursing, that was one of the points when you started someone on an SSRI, that those kind of first couple of weeks was when you really, really did keep an eye on them, and you're looking for their triggers, and you're educating them on how they're going to, how they're probably going to feel, and what they should be looking out for, because it can be quite a dangerous time. And you know, when I started back on mine, I was very aware of that as well, and my mood did fluctuate. It spiked a lot, an awful lot. So the dopamine system is linked to certain types of depression, such as low motivation. Serotonin is more involved in how you process your emotions and how you can affect your overall mood. The way I read it in a number of books when I first really understood what it was that was going on in my head was that serotonin helps the brain to file away the thoughts that you have. You have 60 to 70,000 thoughts a day, they reckon, they being science. But your brain, you know, the fact that I went downstairs and made a coffee a while ago, I don't think about that all the time. I'm not bothered. You know, I do that. You know, that's something I do rote every day. You know, I think about what I'm going to wear, but once it's on, I'm not bothered. But then there's more traumatic thoughts. There's if you suffer from intrusive thoughts, those thoughts bounce around. They bounce around in your head, and the problem is that your brain then latches onto them and goes, "Why am I thinking about that?" And it makes you anxious, and that anxiety is an imbalance, a natural imbalance, and it's a natural reaction, and it's a chemical cocktail of serotonin, dopamine, oxytocin, and your endorphins. You've got your fight or flight response, and that's when you start seeing symptoms like panic attacks and things like that. What they've been able to establish is that serotonin, an imbalance in serotonin, means that the thoughts that you have stay around in your head a bit longer, so you don't necessarily process them properly. So what SSRIs do is they don't necessarily make more serotonin, but they help the brain to keep the serotonin around a little bit longer, and it regulates your emotional processing and your thought processing, which means that you can put some order in your filing cabinets, your mental filing cabinets, and then that process becomes natural. They say it takes 21 days to make a new habit. Taking SSRIs along with therapy and other things like talking, counselling, talking about it, taking exercise, doing these ancillary activities as well as the medication helps your brain to form new pathways. It's very much a Venn diagram. They have to be linked, certainly in my experience anyway.
The talk about that, the way it was described to me once was, if you think of it, certainly with ingrained habits and negative thoughts, intrusive thoughts, if you think of all the thought pathways as like electricity, and if you think of an electrical circuit, the power will always take the path of least resistance. So, and it works the same way with your thought pathways.
Mm.
So, I mean, some of it relates to, I think it was a neuro-linguistic programming session that I went to in one job or other that I had. But they were talking about forming new pathways in your brain, and it's like all it is you need to entrench that one. So that becomes the path of least resistance, and that's the way your mind goes. So forming new associations and things. And I think it kind of ties in with that chemical process.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. In a 2014 review, serotonin was also linked to other conditions, including anxiety disorders, autism, and bipolar disorder. And this is specifically related to me, and I talked about this a lot in episode 2. Researchers found that low serotonin binding among people with OCD and social anxiety resulted in less available serotonin in the brain. So what that means is, for me, when I was having problems with my obsessive compulsive symptoms, it means that the body was processing it quicker than it should have done, so it wasn't hanging around long enough for the brain to make proper use of it. So what an SSRI does is it says, hang on, just chill out a minute, let's just leave this around for a little while. It's like steeping a tea bag for a little bit longer. My sister basically waves a tea bag over the cup, so there's an essence. It's like
homeopathic
tea.
My mum's the same.
Yeah, it doesn't look. Whereas, you know, if I do have tea, on the rare occasions I do have tea, it's builder's tea because it's there forever, and you have to chew it. But so that's basically in a rather crude nutshell what an SSRI does is it leaves the teabag in a little bit longer. In addition, they found that people on the autistic spectrum are more likely to have lower levels of serotonin in certain areas of the brain. This is all very new science, so there's still a lot going on there. So that, you know, obviously that's subject to development.
So they'll be making more links. Yeah. And working out exactly how that works.
How that works, yeah. Bipolar disorder was also associated with altered serotonin activity. They've known about that for quite a while, which may influence the severity of someone's symptoms, especially if it's fluctuating. But the main difference is there's a close link between dopamine and how you experience pleasure. Dysfunction of the dopamine system might also contribute to bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. Serotonin affects emotional processing, which can have effects on mood. The most interesting thing, which I didn't actually know, because it's never really come up, but I didn't realise that dopamine and serotonin are in your gut, and they play a huge role in digestion. So dopamine's role in digestion isn't well understood. However, they do know that it regulates the release of insulin from your pancreas, which I didn't know. And then serotonin, about 95% of your body's serotonin is in your gut. And it's released when food enters the small intestine, which helps stimulate contractions, which then the peristalsis that pushes your food through your intestines. So
is that why when you panic, your stomach, you feel sick?
Possibly. Well, it does. In this article, it's an article that I'm reading from healthline.com, which is quite good because it also provides references as well. Your gut releases extra serotonin when you eat something harmful. So the extra serotonin makes the contractions in your gut move faster in order to get rid of the harmful food, usually through vomiting or diarrhea. So low serotonin in your gut, on the other hand, is associated with constipation.
All right.
Which kind of makes sense considering other symptoms of depression. That, you know, I've certainly experienced that, and I know a lot of people who have depression have problems with their gut motility.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's that's really, really interesting.
And I suppose loss of appetite as well. I mean, although that could be more of a motivational thing, you know, it's very much layman opinion from me, but
No, well, you know, anecdotally. Yeah. Anecdotally, it's important, and we'll get onto that as well later on in the episode. Serotonin's role in relating the sleep-wake cycle is another thing. So we're going from nose to toes, really. Mm. It really has a large effect. In a part of your brain called the dorsal raphe nucleus, the high serotonin is associated with wakefulness. However, an accumulation of serotonin in the area over time may put you to sleep, apparently. Serotonin is also involved in preventing rapid eye movement sleep. Studies have shown that increased serotonin through the use of SSRIs reduces REM sleep. That's interesting to me because something that I've always experienced when I've gone through, you know, the cycles of stopping medication and starting medication is when I'm titrating up into a dose. So gradually increasing into a dose which is considered therapeutic for my condition at the time, I always dream more. I have loads and loads of dreams. And what you often see in the leaflet documentation that you get with tablets is with SSRIs is you may experience nightmares, and I do. I horrific nightmares. But logically, that makes perfect sense to me because if serotonin has long been linked to dreaming, which is why I find that a little bit interesting that it's supposed to reduce REM sleep. I've always had more dreams on SSRIs, and I know a great number of people who have as well. But the problem is, when you have, you only tend to remember the horrible dreams, the nightmares, the ones that wake you up, the ones that leave you in a cold sweat, the ones that really make you feel unpleasant. So I still have nightmares every now and again. I had a nightmare the other day that was it was horrible. It was about like zombies and dead bodies and being chased by things. It was grim. But I remember that one quite vividly. The random kind of, you know, nondescript, neither here nor there dreams you don't remember. But if you increase your dreaming by, say, 30% or 40% because you're on medication that makes you dream more, the chances are, out of those dreams, you're going to have more nightmares. So when somebody suddenly goes, "Oh, I'm having nightmares all the time," you're probably not having nightmares all the time, but of those dreams, the extra dreams that you're having, more of them are likely to be nightmares just because you're increasing the number of dreams that you're having.
Yeah, and you're increasing the number of dreams that you're having while still improving your mood.
Mm.
So, it makes sense to me that anxieties and depressive episodes or things that have triggered depression would surface, manifest in dreams, and sometimes your mind interprets things in a very strange way.
Yeah.
Like I strongly believe that there's meaning to dreams, and not in a way that you're sort of being given messages from the beyond, but your subconscious mind, I believe that your subconscious mind will put stuff together, make connections that you're not necessarily aware of when you're awake, and that will put connections together, and that will manifest in a dream. Sometimes the dream is completely bizarre. I have a lot of very vivid, very odd dreams, and sometimes they're quite epic and involved. Yeah. But
we were talking about the tooth falling out dream the other day. I have that all the time.
For me, it's never my teeth falling out. I've had I assume it's an anxiety dream, is that my teeth don't fit together and I can't bite. Now, whether it's because I'm grinding my teeth in my sleep or something, maybe, or clenching my teeth, but I always have the dream. It's not that I'm losing my teeth. It's that when I
bite down,
my jaw doesn't match, or some of my teeth don't touch, or like the teeth at the back fit together but the front ones don't, or the other way around, and it's quite uncomfortable, and I can feel the discomfort in my jaw.
Are you like chewing on the pillow when you're asleep or something, so you can't shut your mouth? How weird. When I dream the tooth loss dream, it always comes with, I'll pull one tooth out but like half my jaw will come out with it, so I've got like half of my lower mandible in my hand. And that's an odd feeling.
Yeah, I have had that dream once, actually, and I was just thinking, oh, how do I fix this?
Mm.
Not that really shouldn't have happened.
No.
It was just, oh, no, well, I've got to fix this now.
I often have that when I've got a high temperature, a fever.
Yeah,
fever dreams, yeah. So, you know, that's a very brief intro into serotonin and dopamine. But one of the reasons, there's a number of reasons why we wanted to talk about it. One, because we were both having conversations about just trippy dreams we've been having recently. And also, we both read an article, a couple of articles about serotonin and dopamine, but also microdosing. Now, what microdosing is the act of consuming what is known as sub-perceptual amounts of psychedelic drugs. So we're talking things like LSD, psilocybin mushrooms, peyote cactus, that kind of thing.
MDMA
as well. Yeah. In terms of formal testing on this, medical testing, it's in its very, very early stages. However, you'll see certain articles on the BBC News and websites saying that there is definitely some kind of causal link which they're investigating. On an anecdotal level, online there are hundreds of websites about microdosing and their and its ancillary benefits. The most well researched and balanced website we've found from doing some research is one called The Third Wave, which we'll put on. And before we get into this, I'm going to reiterate their disclaimer because it's kind of important to do so. LSD is a potentially illegal substance, and while they don't encourage or condone the use of the substance where it's against the law, they do accept that illegal drug use occurs, and they believe that offering responsible harm reduction information is imperative to keep people safe. And I absolutely agree with that. People are going to use them anyway, and if you're going to use it safely. We're not condoning that. We're not recommending that you do it. It's not something that I'm particularly keen on doing anytime soon. Just because the idea of using any kind of hallucinogen terrifies me. But it's very interesting to see what kind of effect it has. Going into it more, the sub-perceptual means that it's not enough to actually induce visual or auditory hallucinations, but it's just enough to what they call improve cognitive flow, I think is the phrase they use.
Yeah,
it's roundabout.
Well, what they've said here, this was an LSD study, because an article I've read on UK, the Business Insider, is this is focusing on how it's used. Silicon Valley seems to be where the first reports came from of people using microdoses of drugs, mainly LSD and MDMA, in different articles that I've read. But all the studies on psychedelic drugs have been done with what's deemed a full dose. So the example they use is a study that focused on LSD. The participants were injected with 75 micrograms of the drug in 10 millilitres of saline, which was considered, that's enough to trip. By contrast, LSD microdoses report taking about 10 micrograms, so that's roughly one-fifth to one-tenth of a standard recreational dose once every 4 days. And these levels are intended to be sub-perceptual, and that is too small to inspire technical or hallucinations, but large enough to enhance a sense of mental flow. So I think it's sort of stimulating your creativity and your focus. There's a lot of reports that saying most of the information out there is self-reported from people who are using this themselves. There's discussion boards on sites like Reddit, and there's some more organised written accounts by doctors, and there's a book reference called The Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. I don't know anything more about it than the title because I haven't looked at it. But people do report enhanced creativity and fewer symptoms of anxiety and depression. Claims remain unverified. Yeah. There's no information on whether they were using other medication that could be interfering with those results. So at the moment, nothing can be taken as scientifically reliable.
Yeah, but the anecdotal evidence is strong.
Yes.
And one thing we were kind of talking about why people have come to this, and I think there is a certain movement of people who are looking at alternatives to medication. Sometimes there's a lot of people for whom medication doesn't work for them, doesn't fit into their lifestyle.
Standard
prescription medication doesn't work for them. But also, one of the things that we, you know, that is very apparent in this day and age, certainly in countries like the US, medication's expensive, incredibly expensive, and prohibitively so in certain cases. People are looking for alternatives, which means that they can get tangible results by not necessarily bankrupting themselves. And what that's meant is, sometimes they've gone to what is considered an illegal means to find something, and that there's certainly an element of that in why people do it, but also the growing amount of information about anecdotally how effective this is. As you can see now, people are now doing clinical trials as to how this would actually work. Now, putting my cynical hat on, there's obviously going to be an element of, if this does work, how can we monetize it? Then it becomes part of the insurance system, etc. Rah rah rah, and then you're perpetuating the problem. When you look at places like Portugal, who have decriminalised a lot of drugs now, it'd be interesting to see what happens there when people are allowed to maintain that kind of balance themselves. But to go into the actual function of microdosing, many antidepressants, as we talked about just before. SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, as in a long form, try to make serotonin more plentiful in the brain to make you feel better. Psychedelics work more directly by mimicking serotonin. This means that one of their main effects is to stimulate a serotonin receptor located in the prefrontal cortex, which is called 5-HT2A. Stimulation of the 5-HT2A receptor leads to the production of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF. BDNF on this website is described like miracle grow for your brain. It stimulates growth, connections, and activity. It also is noted for the increased transmission of glutamate. Glutamate is the neurotransmitter that is most responsible for brain functions like cognition, learning and memory. Glutamate, there's also some research looking into glutamate transmission in multiple sclerosis for when the sclera, the plaques,
yeah,
break those connections, and how glutamate then drives new connections. Yeah.
Oh, right.
Glutamate and BDNF work together in ways we're still understanding, but it's becoming clear that having more of each leads to many benefits we are seeking from microdosing. Another thing that psychedelics do is to cause parts of the brain that might not actually communicate with one another to communicate with one another. See, now, that sentence in itself, given my overt propensity to be anxious, freaks me out. As far as I'm concerned, parts of the brain that don't normally communicate with each other don't, because they're not supposed to. And the idea of hallucinating terrifies me. I've only ever hallucinated once when I had flu, and it frightened the hell out of me. Maybe I need to get over that. Maybe there's something in there that might help me. But, you know, there we are. So psychedelics allow these unique connections to be formed by dampening the activity of an often overused part of the brain called the default mode network. The default mode network is an area of the brain used for different mental activities, including daydreaming, self-reflection, and thinking about the past or the future. Wow, my default mode network is... I mean, if it was... I'd look like a Mekon.
Yeah, a little extension on
your
head.
I just need... I've got a granny flat of extra default mode network, because I use a lot of that. Some studies suggest that depression is linked to an overactive DMN. Preach, I would agree with that. It is possible that a highly active DMN causes us to ruminate, overanalyze ourselves, and step out of the present moment to consciously question the past and the future. Yep, agreed. It helps explain why these substances could be used to combat depression and anxiety. If it dampens that down, that would make sense, because you'd end up becoming more present mind awareness,
yes,
wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So all of us at some point in our lives have experienced a flow state. The surfer effortlessly riding a big wave. This is verbatim, this bit from the Third Wave website, which I'll put a link to. The surfer effortlessly riding a big wave. The therapist perfectly in sync with a client. The salesman working the room in an out-of-body experience are all examples of people performing their best while in flow. Simply put, flow is truly one of the greatest experiences of being human. We have no specific non-anecdotal evidence to suggest that microdoses of psychedelics can induce flow states, but we know that moderate doses can change the function of the brain in a way very similar to that seen in flow states. I've experienced that before, when I've just been just on it, and I'm,
yeah,
you know, and something just clicks, and you, if I've been nursing or if I've been coding, and you just get into this routine, and everything just, it's almost like you're walking through like Grand Central, and everybody just moves, not moves out of your way, but just moves just enough that you can just walk
straight through,
yeah, and everything is just perfect. Psychedelics initiate the neurotransmitter serotonin. When they enter the brain, we know that serotonin is found in higher levels in flow states. Similarly, psychedelics increase the levels of dopamine in the brain, another neurotransmitter which is found in higher levels in flow states. But it's also the ability to dampen down that default mode network, which can allow our brain to make unique connections between areas that don't usually communicate. Now, see, that puts me a little bit more at ease, because if my default mode network is the thing that's loud, then if I've got areas of the brain that don't usually communicate, it's not necessarily because they're not supposed to, it's because maybe they can't, because I'm too loud.
That's in the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's blocking that pathway.
That makes more sense. So, so we've talked about microdosing and how you do it. For LSD, a microdose is typically between 6 and 20 micrograms, which can equate between 1/16 and 1/5 of a single tab of acid, as they call it. So the drawback to this method is a lack of precision. When you're talking about taking a tab of acid, they use what they're calling here blotter acid. So it's blotter paper. What they say is, if you had one, you would cut it up. But obviously, you don't know how much is one in each bit, so it's not accurate.
You could actually be getting all of it or nothing at all.
Hardly any of it. Yeah. So there's a doctor called Dr. James Fadiman, the author of the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide, who recommends taking a microdose once every 3 to 4 days. And then another lady, where a lot of this information that we read came from, is a lady called Ayala Waldman, and she wrote a book called A Really Good Day: How Microdosing Made a Mega Difference in My Mood, My Marriage and My Life. Waldman discusses a 30-day period of microdosing with LSD to address a variety of psychological symptoms primarily caused by her hormonal changes related to menopause.
Well, hormones can have a massive effect on mood.
Huge. Prior to microdosing, Waldman's mood swings had become so severe as to put her marriage and relationship with her children at risk. Afterwards, in an interview with The Third Wave, she said, "That month changed my life, and I am sad every day that I can't keep doing it legally." So now tens of thousands of people worldwide are being turned on to microdosing, whether it's for mental health problems, boosting creativity, or giving entrepreneurs new directions. So this website is, it strikes me that basically what they've done with this website is they've gone, right, okay, one, there's going to be people who are going to be 100% on board with this, you know, people who've had a long history of taking hallucinogenics. We listened to a couple of podcasts. We've talked about a couple of podcasts that we listened to where the main protagonists are very open about their mental health conditions. One of the podcasts we listened to, last podcast on the left, Marcus Parks has bipolar disorder. He says that intentionally microdosing with psilocybin mushrooms completely changed his life, and he's now much more stable, along with other medications that he takes as well. He said it did have a massive effect on his mental health. But also, there's going to be detractors. There's going to be people who will automatically go, no, it's illegal, it's bad, therefore we shouldn't be doing it. So I've had a good old route around on this website, and to putting my objective hat on, it does look like they've put a lot of effort into creating a balanced view, a lot of research. There's a lot of evidence, there's a lot of acknowledgement that the science is still new, that it isn't backed up with double blind tests and things like that, and they do talk about the benefits, the risks, the legalities of it. So while it's certainly an oversimplification, people generally microdose for two different reasons: to decrease the frequency and intensity of undesirable mental states, or improve the frequency of desirable mental states. So they're talking about, when they're talking about reducing the intensity of undesirable states by various forms of mental illness, they're talking about depression, anxiety, ADHD, mood disorders, post-traumatic stress and addiction. Increasing desirable states, creativity, energy, the flow states they talk about previously, productivity, athletic coordination, leadership development. I think athletic coordination would be quite difficult given how heavily tested they are. You're essentially, microdosing, I think that would be...
I think it would probably show difficult. Up as a banned substance.
I think they probably would, yeah. Risks. By far the riskiest thing they point out by microdosing is the law. It's crucial to check your local laws before microdosing, as the penalties for LSD possession are still harsh in most countries. I mean, it's a category A drug, class A drug here, isn't it? Is it class A or class B?
It's still...
Google it.
I
read out.
I'll Google
do
it.
Do the Googles.
I will do the Googles.
Other search engines are available. So it's crucial to check
Ask Jeeves.
your local laws before microdosing, as the penalty is still harsh. It's still possible to microdose LSD legally. Now, I'm assuming, I'm going to follow this little rabbit hole, because I would wonder whether or not that's only in certain countries. I suppose you could go on a retreat. You could go to...
It is Class A in the UK. So are mushrooms.
Yeah.
Class A drugs. I'll just go through them. Crack cocaine, ecstasy, MDMA, heroin, LSD, magic mushrooms, methadone and methamphetamine.
Mm.
It surprises me that mushrooms are in there. For possession, you get up to 7 years in prison, an unlimited fine, or both. Supply and production, up to life in prison, an unlimited fine, or both.
Mm.
Yeah, I...
Given that, but it says here, aside from the legal risks, one can consider microdosing to be a safe, non-threatening introduction to the benefits. And they've got a chart on this website which is comparing the relative harms of common substances. Now, it's a graph that's in reducing order, based on the overall harm score of different drugs, starting with alcohol and moving right the way down to magic mushrooms. This drug considers specific drug mortality, drug-related mortality, loss of relationships, injury, crime, environmental damage, and a whole host of other negatives associated with each drug. Now, it would be no surprise to anybody listening, really, that alcohol is by far at the top with a combined score of 72, then heroin 55, crack cocaine 54, crystal meth is 33 and next in line. Right down at the bottom with a score of 6 is mushrooms, and a score of 7 is LSD. So having said that, they do warn that psychedelics are very powerful and even microdoses have a risk potential. Emotional turbulence or anxiety is possible while microdosing because psychedelics do have an amplifying effect. LSD tends to amplify your current mood rather than acting as a stimulant or a numbing agent, which is why when the website, the podcast we've listened to, when Marcus was talking about how he microdosed with mushrooms or took mushrooms, he always says, you know, you've got to have somebody with you who knows, who you trust, either who's somebody who's done it before or somebody you trust implicitly to keep you calm, because if you have a bad trip, as they say, it can make things very, very difficult for you. Since there's no clinical research on the safety of microdosing, it's best to avoid microdosing for extended periods of time. There is a potential heart risk of taking too many large doses of psychedelics over a long period of time, although we don't know how this translates to microdosing. So there is a huge volume of links and information about how this works, going on from the pharmacological function to the legalities to anecdotal experiences. It's a very interesting website, and it does make me think about what it would be, what the treatments are going to be like in the future for this kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, they're talking about using MDMA for PTSD. They're talking about using it for Parkinson's disease. Well, talking about a lot of
this. This made me think about, there was an article that I read in the Big Issue about, oh gosh, it must be 16, 17 years ago. And it was also featured, they featured the guy on the BBC. It was a man who'd been diagnosed with early onset Parkinson's, and I think he was only in his early 40s, and he'd already had it for a couple of years, and he, at the time, he was being treated with L-DOPA, which I think is the old,
that's the one, if you've ever seen the film Awakenings, that's the drug that they're talking about. Yeah. There,
and he had some movement, but he also had the shakes that people associate with
tremors, yeah.
Yeah, with Parkinson's, and he was still mobile, but obviously quite limited. And he'd said about, you know, he'd gone to a party and someone had offered him ecstasy, and he said, you know, I don't want to talk about the risks and the legalities. I know all about that. And as far as medical risk goes, you know, my life isn't particularly brilliant at the moment. I'm here to talk about what happened when I took it.
Mm.
And he said, you know, he was dancing and his movement was fluid, and he could move like he hadn't been able to in years, and he went and he told his consultant about it, and instead of brushing him off and saying he shouldn't be doing illegal drugs, mm-hmm. his consultant said, right, I want to know more about this because that sounds incredible. And this was the bit that they featured on the BBC. He said to him, right, what I want you to do is stop taking your L-DOPA
mm-hmm.
for something like two, I can't remember the period of time, but it was like a couple of days
yeah.
before. And then I want you to come into hospital for your appointment and take your ecstasy pill under the, so it's under controlled circumstances, under a controlled environment,
mm-hmm.
and we'll be able to monitor you all the way through. So he was wheeled in on a trolley because he could barely move at all
because he'd stopped taking his L-DOPA.
Yeah. And once the ecstasy tablet had kicked in, they took him to a dream. He was doing forward rolls, he was walking, he could do there's like a solitaire peg test, that's the dexterity test that I do, and it's used as a sort of baseline to, and you repeat it every 12 months to see if there's been any deterioration. But he had the dexterity to do that. Blimey. And they said, you know, hopefully this will trigger further research into the connection between serotonin and Parkinson's and other degenerative neurological conditions. And at the end of it, he said, you know, it's too disorientating to take all the time because it is still a psychedelic, and also there's the associated risks with not knowing what you're getting, how strong it is, and not to mention that it's illegal. But it made me think that, you know, perhaps the microdosing could tie into that, you know, because it a full dose is too disorientating to take, because it's not just the movement that he was getting, but it was the psychedelic effects as well. But it was really, really interesting, and the difference. It's like when you see the anecdotal evidence about cannabis and the pain killing effects. And
I mean, we've talked about CBD and THC on here in earlier episodes.
In fact, yesterday we were laughing about the fact that on the day Canada legalized it across the country,
It sold out.
It sold out in the first day.
Yeah.
But you know, it's there's a lot to be said for knowing exactly what you're getting and it being detailed and monitored and you know, consistent.
And I'd very much like to do a little bit more in a later episode about why certain drugs were made illegal. There's a lot of stories about the real reason why cannabis was made illegal was because hemp was seen as a threat to the cotton industry, and that's a long-standing whether that's apocryphal, I'm not going to stand by that until I've done a bit more research. That just came off the top of my head, but you know,
I reckon
there's a lot of a bloke down the pub said, but there's also, you know, there's also some evidence to suggest that when, you know, in the 1910s, before, you know, what are now Class A drugs were made illegal, it had a far less damaging societal impact, you know, by comparison. I mean, obviously, so psychosocial levels of poverty, etc., were different then to how they are now. But
was it cocaine or heroin cough drops you could get?
There was a baby ointment, like a, you know, you've got a colicky baby, and it had cannabis, heroin, it had cannabis, opium, cocaine, and brandy in it. I mean, it's just bonkers.
So that's not going to make you feel better.
Exactly. But no, I mean, allowing for societal changes, comparatively, the impact on the country was less damaging than a lot of people suggest that it is now that it's illegal, because you've got the black market, you've got people, you know, people having
gangs.
You've got organized crime, and you've also got people who have to resort to illegal means in order to get the drugs in the first place.
Yeah.
So that would be interesting, but I still think we're a few years off in this country. I think we're still a few years off a sensible discussion about the decriminalizing of all drugs, because of the type of people who are currently in control of those laws are the kind of people who blindly just say no. I think you said it best a couple of weeks ago, where you said that the politician who does that is alive now, but they're in school.
Yeah.
You know, we're a few years.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that was said to me at a conference, but I do agree with it. And without getting too political, there's also the people currently in government. And not just in the UK, but I would imagine that there's a lot of shareholders of pharmaceutical industries. So until they work out, like you say, a way to monetize it, because if people found that they could get access something else that would have the same or a better effect than what they're currently being prescribed and paying a lot of money for. I mean, I know drugs aren't as expensive in this country, but there's a lot of hoops to jump through to get access to.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you can even, if it's even funded at all. Mm. So we do have a certain aspect of the cost, but certain, mm. but not as, it's not as much of an impact as places like the States, mm. where you get into insurance covering and yeah. co-pays and all the rest, nonsense, all the rest yeah. of it. And it still costs people a lot of money to be ill.
Yeah, it costs. But and I think putting my my conspiracy hat on, I think also there'll be a lot of people high up, a lot of lobbyists high up who will be objecting to it, not through any moral or religious or any kind of objections in that sense. It's just that they don't want them to be legal because they can't make money off it yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's them specifically. If you make it legal, somebody is going to make money off it. Of course they are. The government or the private enterprise, whoever. But your GlaxoSmithKlines, your Bayers, your those kind of people, your Janssen Silags and all the chemical, the companies that make these medications, if they don't have a slice of that pie, they're powerful enough to affect legislation.
Yeah, because they will have, they'll be supporters of various political parties and institutions. And while there is the argument that you're paying for, the reason drugs are so expensive is because you're paying for the research and development of all the drugs that don't make it. And yes, I agree with that. Mm. Obviously, that research needs to be paid for. Scientists need to be employed. Pharmacists, pharmacologists, etc. But you're also paying, there's also a hefty chunk going to shareholders who aren't really doing anything more than sitting on a board of directors, if yeah. that even.
Yeah.
They're just taking a slice of it. And the money they invested in the first place in buying the shares is long gone.
Yeah.
So it's now, they're now just taking a percentage of the profits. So, mm. Like you say, it will be how they can maintain that same level. They won't be willing to I don't think they'll be willing to entertain legalising other substances until they can work out a way to make the same level.
It all comes down to the bottom line.
Maintain their level,
which is a negative way to end the podcast. And yeah. I'd rather not do that. But it's interesting. It's really, really interesting to look into this. And although the idea of microdosing frightens me, even if it was legal, I think with a bit more research and a bit more understanding, I don't think I could conclusively rule it out. I don't feel like I'm in a position where I need that right no. now. I feel like I've been relatively stable for a number of years, but I certainly wouldn't rule that out for people who do need it. I think if that kind of thing works for you and you're in a position to take it safely yeah. and legally, we're not your parents.
No, we're not
the police, careful. We're not the police, but just be careful.
Be aware of the risks before yeah. Look into all the risks before you go ahead with anything.
Yeah.
And as far as side effects, I mean, let's face it, over-the-counter medications and prescription medications can have some pretty horrendous side effects.
Well, yeah, you've been documenting yours over the last couple of weeks since you've gone on to yeah. on to the full dose of your meds, and it's pretty grim, isn't it?
That was something we haven't done an update with. Actually, it's not as bad as, and I hope I'm not jinxing this, it's not quite as bad as some of some effects that I've read and I've heard about, but it's very early days. I know yesterday I had a bit of a turn, much later in the day than I was expecting, actually, because I think I took my morning dose at about 8:30, 9 o'clock, and it wasn't until it was about 1 or 2 o'clock I suddenly had a hot flush and I had to sit down and kind of be quiet. And it was a bit difficult because we had family over.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of people who hadn't seen each other for a long time. And one of my cousins was over and my dad was there, and he hadn't seen John in years. We couldn't even work out. We know it was sometime after our wedding, because he was there, but we couldn't work out how long it was. My auntie was over from the States. My other auntie and uncle came over because they're staying with them. So there were a lot of people in a small room, and it was quite loud, people talking. So I was felt a little bit removed from it because I wasn't feeling very well. And I spent a lot of last night awake wondering if I was going to be sick or not, because the first time I've experienced real nausea from it. I thought I'd kind of skipped that, yeah. I'd avoided that, but yeah, it was pretty grim. But in terms of other side effects, fatigue, Thursday was an absolute write-off. I got absolutely nothing done at all. But Thursday was the worst day of the previous week. Yeah. So it stands to reason that when I'm taking double the dose,
over the same time scale. Yeah, and you seem perkier today as well, so that's good.
Yeah. But we'll see. I had a bit of a rest a couple of hours ago. And yeah, I think that's kind of
helped.
Given me a bit of a boost, having a little cat nap. And that might be something that I just have to factor in for a few weeks, that if I have a bad night and I'm restless and feeling ill, I just have to factor in
A couple of naps during the day makes sense.
It's still not enough to say that I would ever recommend someone not take it.
Or
say, it's going to be horrendous for a couple of weeks.
Well, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
But we'll keep that updated as well. An interesting episode this week. It certainly gives me a lot to think about. I know a few people who listen to the podcast who will have very strong opinions. I think both ways, really. Some people are very pro, some people are very anti. It'd be interesting to see what people say. And obviously, there's some people who have their own anecdotal experiences of serotonin and dopamine and using other things to regulate that, like exercise. We've talked about that before. Exercise has a massive effect on serotonin and dopamine. And I can certainly attest to that.
Would you say you get an endorphin rush after you've done exercise? And I was having a conversation yesterday about, we were talking about the sort of motivation to, especially if exercise in a chance, in terms of like going for a run or going to the gym, or is something that you have, because some people just continue to do it from childhood, and it's just they don't consider it not being part of, they can't imagine it not being part of their life. But for some people, myself included, it's very much an effort to go and do it, and the anticipation is always far worse than the actual
doing it or
afterwards. I mean, there's sometimes in yoga class when there's a particularly difficult posture or something that I've not done before, halfway through I'll be thinking, I hate this, is it nearly time to go home? But I always feel better for doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of which, I think I might go out for a little run now, depending on the weather. But so we'll round it up there. As ever, we're really interested in hearing what you think about these subjects. If you've got any links to stuff or any opinions, I'd love to hear.
Yeah, further reading will be
really
good.
Further reading will be really good, yeah, definitely. So that is podcast@thinkinghabits.co.uk is the email. We're on at Thinking Habits on Instagram and Twitter, and we're on Thinking Habits Podcast on Facebook. So send your stuff there. And as we always say, keep talking. And if you need to talk, you know where we are.
Bye.
Bye.